It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. In an attitude of prayer, let us learn how to open our gifts. Christmas is coming, wrapped presents are everywhere, and we still struggle to know how to open our gifts, even to recognize them. The pure gift of just being here, what's that worth? And being with people we love and who love us, what's that selling for on the Tao? And our health, whatever degree of health we have, it's better than having a lot less health. It makes a big difference. What's that worth? So many gifts, and so many of us who have not learned how to see them. Let us become aware of those simple gifts of being here, loving and being loved, the gifts of our health. Those gifts are the real treasures of this holiday season, and we don't have to wait until Christmas to open them. In fact, it's best that we don't wait. Let us open our gifts of life, love, and spirit, and spread them all around our lives, sitting there right in the middle of them. That will help us prepare for Christmas by reminding ourselves that we already have the really important gifts. While on Christmas morning, we can open our gaily wrapped trinkets and toys. Amen. Tricky preaching Christmas sermons, Easter sermons. I mean, those are the two times that some of you are coming to church. It's really not so true here. But you still come with a wide range of expectations and fears or disgusts. If you're coming looking for magic, you might be coming thinking, all right, it's a church, it's Christmas, tell me a story. Take me in, tell me something that'll make me all wide-eyed, make me believe something that I know isn't so. Tell you what, if you pretend to believe it, I'll pretend to believe it, and we'll fake it through another holiday. You may not want to say that out loud, but some of you recognize the sentiments. Others come from very different religious backgrounds. Some of them unhappy religious backgrounds, and you may be thinking very different things. You might be thinking, all right, it's that Christmas season, and I know what that means. That means preachers all lie, because they know they can get away with it. Don't lie to me. Not even at Christmas. Especially at Christmas. Don't lie to me. Don't demean my mind or my soul. More than anything in the world, I need the one thing churches don't seem capable of giving. I need the truth. Now again, most of you are way too polite to say that, but you may recognize the sentiment of that kind of skepticism. And others among you are in between, wondering and hoping that there might somehow be truth that's still magical or magic that's true. And really, this is the kind of range of expectations and attitudes that people bring every single Sunday to every single church. There are the skeptics in need of truths that are magical, and the believers in need of magic that might be true. Religions always teach through stories, and a lot of people think that you only use stories if you can't find facts. But the truth is that we much prefer good stories to facts. Now, that's a religious lesson, but I didn't learn it from a school of religion. I first learned it from a diaper commercial. You learn where you learn. In the 1950s, Pampers, disposable diapers, came out. Now, I don't know how many of you remember that or would even care about it. But what I remember about it is that advertisers are restrained by law from saying absolutely blatant lies. They have to sugarcoat them. But they can't just say, this car is the best car ever made. No car on earth is anywhere near as good or as safe. They can't say that because all the other car manufacturers want to argue with them. Theoretically, there might sometime be a product that actually is the best made where they could say that. That's what happened in the 1950s when Pampers came out. They were the best disposable diaper in the world. Okay, they were the only disposable diaper in the world. And they were the best. And so Procter & Gamble decided to try something very bold. And they tried it in Texas. I don't know why, but this was the test market. They decided to come out with their marketing campaign for Pampers, simply telling the truth. So they came out with a marketing campaign here that said, Pampers, the best disposable diapers in the world. Nobody bought them. You'd think they'd sell. Nobody bought them. Those were even the facts. Nobody argued. Nobody took them to court. It was true. Nobody cared. So their advertising company said, well, we could have told you so. People don't like truth. We'll just do it the old-fashioned way. And so they came up with an advertising slogan that said, a Pampers baby is a happy baby. The rest is history. Merchants couldn't keep them on the shelves. Apparently, it wasn't very important to parents to have the best diaper in the world, but those three words, a happy baby, oh, they call up a whole picture, a whole story, a movie. A happy baby lives in a happy family with a happy mommy and a happy daddy, who are doing a wonderful job of parenting, which is something they were a little nervous about. And it might keep the baby dry too, who knows. That's worth buying diapers for. The truth is, we don't care a lot about the truth of something once it's wrapped in a good story. Now, you may doubt this, I know. There are skeptics and rationalists and people with all sorts of mental viruses like that sitting right here in this room, and you may doubt that. You may even subscribe to the myth that human beings are rational. That's a laugh. If you doubt it, just think, imagine, try to count the numbers of the people sitting in audiences all over the country this season who were moved, I kid you not, who were moved to tears, this is the truth, moved to tears by the sight of mice dancing on the stage, dancing around a nutcracker. And they were moved to tears. And if you haven't seen the Nutcracker Suite, just think of movies, any movies. People sit there, they're wide-eyed, tears run down their cheeks. There's not a word going on that's true in one sense. But it's a story so big, it invites us in, and we are suckers for good stories, whether they're true or not. And that's the danger. 24 centuries ago, Plato, who didn't trust stories, even though he was one of the best storytellers in Western history, Plato was the one who defined myths as lies because they can take you in so much. We love being taken in by stories. We just wish that when they took us in, they'd take us in for our benefit rather than the benefit of the storyteller. If only that could happen, we'd be happy. We had a bunch of people here Friday night, two nights ago, for our third Friday spiritual movie night that we have on the third Friday of each month. And we saw four short movies. Now, normally, if you think about what kind of stories do people like, and you look at the movies that are selling, it looks like we like two kinds of stories. We like war, and we like love. And those may be sex-linked, those preferences. Friday night, it's Christmas, I picked them. We just had four love movies, very different kinds of love. Everyone in the room was taken in. We were all enchanted, regardless of who we were. So maybe the truth is that we prefer love stories, whether we're men or women. Men just are a little more hesitant to admit it. They're certainly our favorite kind of stories for Christmas time. But at Christmas time, you've changed keys into a different kind of love story. What that's supposed to be about is a spiritual love story, something with some depth, something kind of cosmic. Spiritual love stories are much deeper things. You'd think they're much harder to tell true ones of. They may be. They're talking about a cosmic kind of love. They're talking about affirming who we are as precious and sacred people all the way down. They're stories to take us in and make us believe we're okay. We're not broken. We do okay even in the sight of the gods. You think those are easy stories to tell? They're not easy stories to tell. Because for some reason we don't want to believe that. So I went. I had some stories in mind, but I thought, I'll check with my friend Google, because there have got to be millions of spiritual love stories. Well, I typed in spiritual love stories, and it was one of the most depressing things of this season. There were only 11. None of them from Christianity. One from Islam. Most of them Eastern. And actually, two of those sites, I'm not sure how they got on there. One was a Janet Jackson site, and the other was sort of an adult porn site. So whatever comes to Google's mind on the subject of spiritual love stories, apparently he or she doesn't think about things that are either very spiritual or very loving. So I'll tell you the four stories I was going to tell you anyway. They're some of my favorites. What's at stake here in a spiritual love story is this feeling that we're really okay. Now, there's actually a $2 word for that in religious studies. In the history of Christianity, the word's called justification. For 15 centuries, the Catholic Church told people that they had the authority to tell you whether or not you were justified based on what you did and what they thought and so on and so forth. In the 16th century, a Catholic monk named Martin Luther split from the church, and that's the word he split with the church over, justification. And he said, the church doesn't have the authority to tell you whether you're okay. You are justified by your faith. You don't need the church to mediate it. You don't need anybody to mediate it. You're justified by your faith. Now, that's still easier said than done. And the truth is, Protestant Reformation or not, most churches still do want to believe that they can determine whether or not you're okay. In the last election, you had Catholic bishops saying that people who voted pro-choice shouldn't be given the sacrament of communion. They're not okay. Even as the church forbade any birth control in poor countries where human overbreeding had become as destructive as plagues, famines, and wars. Something's wrong there. Two Baptist churches here in Austin have withdrawn from the Southern Baptist Convention rather than letting that convention determine who is acceptable in the eyes of God. So it still goes on. So I have four stories for you that are spiritual love stories. And I'll try to show you why these are spiritual love stories, not just stories. They have that kind of message, that kind of justification. You'll feel it. The first really isn't a story. It's just a poster. Just a poster that I saw years ago in Detroit. The poster has a black and white photo of a little black boy sitting on the curb in a neighborhood so filthy you wouldn't want to go there even in the daytime. His face is dirty, his clothes are dirty, and he has tear tracks running down both of his cheeks, and he's looking straight at you. And the words at the bottom of the poster say, "But God made me, and God doesn't make junk." That's justification right there. And you read that, and you know that kid is right, and you hope he'll be able to remember how right he is, because he's going to need that faith in what's likely to be a very tough life. There is justification by faith, right there on one poster. It's just lovely. The second story is also one that doesn't come from religion. If you've been here long, you've heard it before, and if you hang around more years, you're going to hear it again. I love this story. A family went into a restaurant. The waitress came up. She took the father and the mother's order. Then she turned to the 7-year-old boy, and she said, "And what'll you have, my friend?" He says, "I'll have a hot dog." And his mother says, "Forget the hot dog. Bring him steak, mashed potatoes, gravy, and carrots." The waitress ignored her. "Would you like ketchup or mustard on your hot dog?" "Ketchup," said the boy. She said, "One hot dog with ketchup coming up." She turned and left for the kitchen. As the parents sat there completely stunned, the little boy sat up suddenly very straight in his seat, and he turned to his parents and he said, "You know what? She thinks I'm real." Justification. He didn't need to be fed as much as he needed to be heard and listened to and valued. And the waitress performed the sacrament of blessing the child right there in the restaurant, in front of his parents. Now that's magic. But if you want really cosmic stories of spiritual love, you probably have to go to some of the great religions for them. Because at their best, the great religions know this is what they're about, and they've got stories about it. And I have two of them. The first comes from Hinduism. And it was told to me by an Indian woman who comes here from time to time. We were talking about the religious education of children a few years ago. And she told me that what children most need are stories that can stretch their souls to infinite size. And she said, almost shaking her finger at me, she said, "Hinduism, you know, has many such stories." And I said, "Okay, tell me one." She said, "I could tell you 1,000. "One." She said, "Very well." So she told me this story, which I'll never forget. And you won't either. It's a story about Krishna, probably the most beloved of the Hindu depictions of deity. She gave me a poster of baby Krishna that I still have in my office. There's this lovely little baby, blue. They paint him blue. Some say the blue is for the infinity of the color of the sky. But Krishna, when he grew up, was a brat. He misbehaved everywhere. He was known for misbehaving. And this is a story about Krishna in school. And his teacher saw Krishna in school, and he was chewing. Now, chewing gum was not allowed in school, and Krishna knew that. And she said, "Are you chewing, Krishna?" "Nope." She said, "You're chewing something. You have something in your mouth, and you're chewing, don't you?" "Nope." So the teacher stormed over to Krishna's chair and asked him to stand up. And she said, "Open your mouth. I want to look in." Krishna said, "All right." And he opened his mouth, and the teacher leaned over and looked in, and inside of his mouth, she saw 10,000 million galaxies. Boy, it doesn't get much better than that. What are the possibilities of a child, including a brat? Infinite. Absolutely infinite. God made me and God didn't make junk. Amazing. You hear a story like that, and if you've grown up in Western religions, you think you're never going to hear a story like that from Western religion, certainly from Christianity, but you'd be surprised at how close they come. One of Jesus' sayings, see if this doesn't sound like the same kind of story. One of Jesus' sayings is about the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God. People both then and now wanted to think that it's some kind of a supernatural thing that comes with special effects and computer graphics. And Jesus said, "No, it's not coming. The kingdom of heaven is not coming." Jesus said that. You can't point to it. It's not coming. The kingdom of heaven is within or among you, period. The kingdom of heaven is within you. My Hindu friend would say, "Of course, if you don't believe it, just open his mouth and look in." It's not bad. The most famous Christian story, and it's the one I have to tell you because it's Christmas, but I wanted to prepare you for it by putting it against this other kind of background. The most famous Christian story is a story of spiritual love. It's the story of the birth of Jesus. Now, scholars will tell you that it's just another virgin birth story, like dozens of other virgin birth stories from all over the world, and that's true. Zeus was always cavorting with young women, and they gave birth to other gods like Dionysus and Hermes and Apollo and Athena and the rest of them. The idea in a virgin birth is that this is a child of God, that there's something beyond speech here. And it's born of a God untainted by all the human failings that we're so aware of in ourselves. That's the idea of the virgin birth thing. And they're usually born to common people. You don't hear many virgin birth stories. I'm not sure I can think of any where they were born to princesses or powerful people or wealthy people. That'd be a different story. The birth of a godlike child can come to anyone, and the gods are in us and with us always. This is very Greek. Any Greeks who are raised in Greek culture still understand their different traits and styles as the traits and styles of gods or goddesses that are alive in them. I read a book by Arianna Huffington, who was raised in Greek culture, and she's Greek. It's a book called The Gods of Greece. It's actually a very interesting book. And she talked about how she was raised knowing that the powerful passions that she had were the passions of the gods and goddesses that she had to attend to, because they wouldn't go away. And she said her whole adult life has been played out trying to balance the sacred demands of two very contradictory goddesses. The goddess Artemis, the goddess of focused, passionate, aggressive, determined women. She's got that. And the goddess Demeter, the great earth mother,
the goddess who guides a single mother who has two daughters. And she's been aware that these are sacred demands in her, that she, look what this does to a life. Look how this ennobles a human life. This isn't a single mother struggling with a big ego who wants to get famous and do things. This is the goddess Artemis, by God, exerting and asserting herself once more, being served by her servant, Ariana. And it is the goddess Demeter, by God, demanding that her servant Ariana be the earth mother to her own daughters. Boy, there is a life played out on a cosmic stage. That's a justification. So these virgin birth stories are ways of saying that something about us as our best, at our best, is sacred, is noble, is precious beyond measure. That's what birth stories are doing. Virgin births were everywhere in the first century. During the life of Jesus, the great Caesar Augustus died, the greatest of the Caesars. He died in August of the year 14. And so in September of the year 14, the Roman Senate, in order to reward Caesar for such a noble life, awarded him a virgin birth. That's how virgin births come. I'm sorry to tell you this. They come after you die. First you live a noble life, and then people can't think of a way to describe what a magnificent person you were without saying, surely, this was a person born of the gods, and then you get a virgin birth. So Jesus' virgin birth story was written decades after the man Jesus died, and it was written in the same way. And look what's in the story and what isn't in the story and what it's saying. It's wonderful. He wasn't born to a princess or the daughter of powerful people, or the story would have said that only the powerful or the royal can embody anything really important. He wasn't born in a castle, or the message would have been that only the wealthy really matter. He was born to a poor woman and man of no particular distinction. And yes, in the first century, all the storytellers knew that Joseph was really his father. Remember, the writers of the Gospels of Luke and Matthew both took great pains to trace Jesus' genealogy back through Joseph, his father. They knew calling him a son of God was poetic. They left it to us to forget. Here in a stable in a cave, far away from the passing glories of royalty, power, and wealth, an ordinary little boy was born who was the hope of the world. I can still hear my Hindu friend saying, if you don't believe it, just look in his mouth. 10,000 million galaxies right there. This is the Christian version of the story of Krishna with the whole universe in his mouth. But great myths are the collective dreams of whole cultures. They're the things we dream about. They're the things we yearn for and are too embarrassed to say out loud. And those wants and needs don't seem to vary so much between people. The kingdom of heaven isn't coming. It's within you, it's among you, or it's nowhere. God made you, and not only are you not junk, you're a child of God and supremely real, and nobody can take that away from you ever. Not friends, not family, not churches, not politicians, nobody. Then just when you could share this great treasure, this great secret you found now, you look around you and you see that your loved ones, your family, your friends, they don't know this secret. Because you have a secret, and most of them don't know that they're children of God and contain infinite possibilities inside of them. They don't know they're the hope of the world. They don't know this great secret. You've learned it, and they don't know it. But they need to know it. They need to know it more than anything. Perhaps you'll find a way to tell them this week. Merry Christmas.